This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room where you, me, the top experts and 28 Minutes come together to understand one of the big issues of the day. Today, we're going to talk about Russia. You probably saw the pictures from Moscow at the weekend, thousands waiting at the airport to welcome Alexei Navalny home. Navalny, Russia's best-known opposition figure, is now under lock and key. Why is Vladimir Putin so afraid of him? Putin v. Navalny. On the Black Sea coast of Russia is a seaside resort called Gelenjik. Just a few miles outside town is a peninsula, and on that peninsula is a palace. A new palace. A palace which someone secretly filmed.
Это новый Версаль или новый Зимний дворец
по-настоящему. This is the new Versailles, or the Winter Palace. A truly royal palace, says the narrator. And it all belongs to Vladimir Putin. A camera on a drone films vast grounds. A purloined floor plan shows an arcade, a spa, a theatre and an ice hockey rink. The two-hour video was released online by the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny to coincide with his surprise arrival back in Moscow on Sunday. The arrival was a surprise because in August, Mr. Navalny survived an assassination attempt in Russia and was treated in Germany for Novichok poisoning. Mr. Navalny was arrested on arrival. The film has been seen by 40 million people. He's inside, the film is out. So what I want to know today is, why is President Putin afraid of Alexei Navalny? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, I want to know about Alexei Navalny the man. Who is he? Where did he come from and what does he believe? I'm joined in the briefing room by Arkady Ostrovsky, who's Russia editor at The Economist.
I've known Navalny for a number of years and he's changed over those years. You know, if you ask me who he was 10 years ago and who he is now, the answers probably would be quite different. What is probably most consistent is extraordinarily focused, determined, quite unassuming, not full of himself, not a traditional politician, as we know, who just sort of gets excited by the sight of the crowd, which he wants to address. I mean, this is a man who he's risen into politics through the internet, through social media, and he existed as a politician and as a blogger online for a long time. I think that switch from online to offline did not come easy to him. If you ask me what kind of man is Navalny today, and I just been with him on the flight from Berlin to Moscow, and I went to see him in October when he just got discharged from the clinic where he was treated for Novichok nerve poisoning. And what I saw is a man who had extraordinary vision, clarity, courage, but definitely not full of himself, very unassuming, doesn't use sort of big heroic words. He just does big heroic deeds.
How did he first come to prominence in Russia?
He came to prominence sort of mostly as a blogger in the 2000s. He was not very well known as a politician. He mixed with not very pleasant or reputable nationalist crowd, participated in the nationalist marches. I think with retrospect, he was sort of searching for an idea, was searching for a movement. He joined one of the more liberal parties. At the same time, as I said, he went on these nationalist marches. Then he started blogging. Some of his early blogs, he would probably rather forget himself. They included sort of patriotic nationalist outbursts about Russia's war in Georgia. Then he seized on the subject of corruption, and that's when I met him. This was about 2008, 2009. And what Navalny was doing is he was buying shares, you know, tiny amount of shares, one or two, in state companies, but that would allow him to go to the annual general meetings and ask questions about how those state companies are spending their money, what their procurement is. He realized that the two subjects that mattered in politics in Russia at the time still matter is nationalism and corruption. He really burst into prominence when he switched from online to offline, and that happened at the time of a really crucial moment in 2011 and 12, when Vladimir Putin decided to return to the Kremlin as president after sitting out one term as prime minister to circumvent constitutional restriction. And they rigged parliamentary election just before that, and Moscow and St. Petersburg and several other cities burst into large protests. And suddenly, Navalny was at the lead of those protests.
When he returned on Sunday, what was he actually arrested for?
The real reasons for arrest and the formal excuses for arrest are quite different things in Russia, although they're intertwined. And it couldn't get more Kafkaesque than that. Formally, he was arrested for breaking parole rules on a suspended sentence which was handed out to him in 2014. That sentence itself was a trumped-up case. It was overturned by the European Court of Human Rights. Russia had to pay compensation to him, but still left that sentence in place. It was a suspended sentence of 3.5 years and demanded him checking in with the police station. But the best bit was this. The reason he couldn't go to check in with the police station was that he was slightly busy recovering from Novichok nerve agent poisoning in Germany.
So let's be clear. He was arrested when he got back to Russia for having broken parole by being poisoned.
Yes. And that actually, that's why I say that leads into understanding that in fact what he was arrested for is for surviving this attack, for exposing in the most extraordinary investigative work done together with Bellingcat, an independent open source investigation and research organization. He exposed the FSB, the Secret Service agents who had been following him for years and who administered this poison, tried to kill him. He actually managed to speak to one of them on the phone, remarkable as it sounds. And of course, his last and biggest crime in the eyes of the Kremlin was that he decided to return to Russia and to face Vladimir Putin and deliver this challenge. Because as far as Putin was concerned, he would far, far rather Navalny stayed in exile, where he would probably get marginalized, like many political exiles had done before him. And in security services, the prosecutors were doing everything in their power to scare him into staying. They've started cases. They warned him he'd get arrested. Navalny ignored that. He is a politician. He is vying for power. He has a project in mind. He has a very clear vision about what he wants to do. And he has almost insane courage to pursue that dream.
Arkady Ostrovsky. Russia has been run by Vladimir Putin for more than 20 years. But after two decades, what do ordinary Russians think about him and the system he runs? Joining me now in the briefing room is Steve Rosenberg, the BBC's Moscow correspondent. Steve, obviously you've travelled a lot around Russia. What do people outside Moscow think of Vladimir Putin now?
I think that when it comes to attitudes to Vladimir Putin, the Russian people divide up roughly into five groups. At the extremes, you've got the Putin lovers and the Putin haters, you know, the Putinophiles for whom the president can do no wrong, and the Putin phobes, those people who are willing to take to the streets to condemn him. But these groups are pretty small, I think. And sandwiched in the middle, you've got the mass, the majority, some of whom vote for Putin because they see no alternative, or they vote for him because they fear change. And that's actively encouraged, I think, by the authorities. And there are many Russians who don't care, really, who's running the country, as long as they're getting paid and their pensions are paid on time. And then there are Russians who don't like the direction their country is moving in, but don't really believe they have the power to change anything, let alone the president. And it's this mass in the middle that the Kremlin relies on, really, to keep control. I'll give you an example. About a year ago, I went to the Russian Rust Belt, the industrial heartland in the Ural Mountains. It was just after President Putin had announced he wanted to change the constitution, which he did, to give himself the right to stay in power until 2036. So I wanted to find out how Russians would react to the idea, you know, of Putin forever. And I saw these five groups of people where I was in Magnitogorsk, this iron and steel city, and Yekaterinburg. So I saw Putin lovers. I met a very colourful babushka called Fanuzia, who gave me pancakes and hot tea and did a bit of dancing in her living room. And then gushed about the president. You know, she was sort of saying, well, he can sing, he can do politics, he can do everything. You know, he's boosted our country. I want him to be president forever. And at the other extreme, I found the Putin haters in Yekaterinburg. There was a tiny protest going on against changing the constitution. And one protester held up a toilet roll. I'll never forget that. And she was shouting out, the authorities are treating the constitution like loo paper. They're using it to wipe their bottoms, which are stuck to the throne. Huh. And I remember going up to one other protester. I think her name was Tatiana. And I asked her why so few people had come out. And she said, the Russian people are sleeping. And one woman I spoke to on the street by a tram stop, she admitted that life was tough. But she said, the main thing is that we have order and we don't have a war. So why risk changing things? And that phrase, the main thing is we don't have a war, you hear that so often. And the Kremlin plays on that and it pushes that to the people.
I imagine from what you're saying that if you talk to people about democracy, that seems like quite an abstract concept.
Democracy itself, that word, has almost become a dirty word, actually. It's become soiled or tarnished in Russia in the economic chaos of the 1990s, just after the Soviet Union collapse. Because for many Russians, democracy sort of became associated with poverty, with inequality, chaos, war. You know, think back to the 1990s and there was the war in Chechnya. And I think Vladimir Putin has exploited that to consolidate his power. What he has done, when he came to power, he put in place this system of Russian democracy. It's often referred to as managed democracy, where the Kremlin does all the managing, basically. So it says democracy on the tin. And if you look at the contents, well, you know, there are elections and there are political parties, the ingredients of democracy. But if you open up the tin, it looks and smells more like autocracy. But, you know, when I meet Russians and I talk to people, I find it's not so much democracy that's their priority. It's social justice. You know, they look around and they see injustice and they see inequality. They see a big gap between rich and poor. They see bureaucrats. They see policemen. They see judges who are on the make. And this need, this desire, this demand for social justice, rather than democracy in itself, I think is rising in Russia.
That's quite interesting because it takes you back to, in a way, to the thoughts about the Arab Spring. I'm not making a comparison here, when the demands really weren't particularly for democracy, but they were about this social justice and they were about how an elite were treating the rest.
Absolutely. But the thing about Russia, I've noticed, is that so many people, you know, they complain about problems, everyday problems, but they don't necessarily blame the guy at the top. They might blame the local mayor or the regional governor or the boss at work, but they don't join the dots. And when you say to people, OK, you don't blame Putin for those problems, but he's been in power for 20 years. don't you think that someone who's been running the country for 20 years should have made a bigger difference to your life? So many people, you can see on their face, they sort of stop and think, oh, I never thought of that. I find that absolutely fascinating, but I think that goes back into Russian history, that traditionally the person running the country is kind of almost this super figure, and you can't really blame them for the problems in the country.
In Moscow, we're used to seeing pictures of demonstrations, sometimes small, sometimes large, but they're always just in Moscow. What has to happen for demonstrations to gain traction outside Moscow?
Well, what we've been seeing in recent years is that social concerns, issues that affect people's lives in their town, in their city, in their region, have been bringing people onto the streets. For example, a couple of years back in Yekaterinburg, again in the Urals, people came out onto the streets to save a park, which was under threat because the authorities and the local church had come up with plans to build a big cathedral on that site. And they succeeded in stopping that. I think the Kremlin's biggest fear is that as economic hardship increases, protests that don't start out particularly anti-Putin will turn into anti-Kremlin demonstrations. And that fear, I think, will have been stoked by last year's big protest in Khabarovsk in the Russian Far East. I mean, these were unprecedented demonstrations. What had happened was that the regional governor had been dramatically detained by officers who'd flown in specially from Moscow. He was bundled into a van. He was flown to Moscow and charged with involvement in multiple murders dating back 15 years. He's not from President Putin's party. He'd actually defeated the Kremlin candidate to win the governorship. And the suspicion is that the Russian authorities were waiting for a moment to move in and to remove him. But this sparked huge anger in Khabarovsk. We saw months of demonstrations, tens of thousands of people coming out onto the street. People felt insulted. And to begin with, the protesters' main demand was, Moscow, send back our governor. We'll put him on trial here in Khabarovsk. And if he's found guilty, then we'll send him to prison. But gradually, week by week, what we noticed was the slogans were becoming increasingly anti-Putin. And so I think there is a fear in the Kremlin. Well, you know, if this can happen in Khabarovsk, a long way away from Moscow, this could happen closer to Moscow. That is Vladimir Putin's biggest fear, I think, that people will rise up, come onto the streets, some kind of Ukraine-style revolution.
When we look at Alexei Navalny, does he have any particular traction with the kind of people you've been meeting and talking to?
If you look at the polling, right, then Mr. Navalny has very minimal popularity across the country. But that's misleading because he doesn't have access to Russian television and TV here, which is the biggest instrument for shaping public opinion. Remember I mentioned that protester in Yekaterinburg who told me that the Russian people are sleeping. I think the Kremlin sees Alexei Navalny as the man who could actually wake people up. He's clearly fearless, and his anti-corruption campaigns and investigations and videos strike a chord. And I think the Kremlin undoubtedly views him as a threat, as someone who could exploit anti-government feelings. And that is why they are, I think, now determined to put him behind bars.
Are you saying that it helps him with the Russian people, that his focus is on corruption and therefore social justice rather than on democracy?
Absolutely. Because, as I say, many Russians see the gap between rich and poor, and they think that's wrong. And so when someone like Alexei Navalny and his colleagues publish anti-corruption investigations, I think that does strike a chord. Now, the Kremlin does all it can to paint Mr. Navalny sometimes as irrelevant, sometimes as a revolutionary sent by the West to cause unrest in Russia. Russian state TV the other day likened him to Vladimir Lenin, who was sent by the Germans back to Russia in 1917 to cause a revolution. So I think that is how the authorities are going to be portraying him, to try to tarnish his reputation amongst the people. But whether that's going to be successful, we'll have to wait and see.
Steve Rosenberg on Russian opinion. Actually, there are elections later this year to the Russian parliament, the Duma. To what extent will they determine the fate of Alexei Navalny? Joining me to discuss this are Catherine Belton, author of Putin's People, and Nikolai Petrov, a senior research fellow at Chatham House. Nikolai Petrov, how much is Vladimir Putin and the system that he's built threatened by this one man, Alexei Navalny?
I think that the scale of this threat did increase very essentially after Navalny's poisoning first, and then after he came back to Russia. I think this is a kind of existential threat for the regime, and we can speak about the political crisis caused in Russia due to Navalny's comeback.
Catherine Belton, the elections to the Duma are coming up in the autumn. Now, how vulnerable is Putin in those elections?
I think this is a key moment for him because really United Russia, the Kremlin ruling party, which has held a majority of the Russian parliament for most of Putin's presidency, now it's struggling to kind of muster 30% in ratings, and they're really kind of in trouble. They don't have any sort of new vision for the country, and I think we can see that people are tired, and this is the problem.
Nikolai, what would constitute in those elections success or failure for Putin?
It's very important to understand that last year Putin did start political transformation aimed to keep him in power after the end of his current presidential term. So the aim now is either to keep qualified majority or at least to have majority in the State Duma, which will enable the Kremlin to continue with political and constitutional transformation without any problems.
Catherine Belton, is there actually any realistic chance of them losing that majority, given how they operate the system?
There's a chance that they may not be able to muster that type of majority, given kind of the falling economy. Russia, for the first time this year, is facing a recession, mostly due to the pandemic, but also because of the Kremlin's heavy-handed tactics in kind of essentially monopolizing most of the economy. Few people have been investing when the security services can seize your business from you at any moment. Russia has really faced a lost decade for economic growth, and people's living standards are falling. So Putin doesn't have the same kind of rosy situation as he has done for most of the previous three terms of his presidency.
Nikolai, does Putin have a story for Russians anymore? An ideology, a kind of overarching notion of what he's for and about that appeals to them?
I would say that no, he doesn't. Russia experienced the biggest growth of personal incomes in the first decade of Putin's rule. Then the idea was that Putin can bring stability, and later, after 2014, he made Russia great again. And annexation of Crimea was culmination of this scenario, which did change attitude to Putin in a very essential way. I would say that his popularity did increase by 20 percentage points, and the way how Russians did perceive serious problems Russia was confronted by did decrease by the same way. However, now there is nothing else he can offer. He can't offer any economic benefits due to stagnation. He can't offer any stability, and Russians are fed with making Russia great again. They think that it's already done. And that's why erosion of Putin's popularity and erosion of his legitimacy is a real threat connected to Navalny.
Catherine, what ultimately does Putin want?
I think probably Putin himself is quite tired of being president. 20 years in such a high-powered, stressful role is a long time. And I think he probably is, despite the referendum last year, which gave him the right to remain in power until 2036. Really, he was trying to buy time to find a successor without destabilizing the status quo and endangering himself and his cronies in power. But it's a real risk to find a successor, and that's why it's essentially the biggest conundrum for Putin.
Nikolai, how much of a dilemma do you think the Kremlin has about how to deal with Navalny and his supporters, particularly if there are the street protests that we've been talking about?
Of course, the Kremlin wants Navalny to disappear, but there is the problem of cost. And in 2013, I would remind that Navalny was planning to participate in Moscow mayoral elections. And the Kremlin initial response was to arrest him in order not to allow his participation. But it caused unrest. A huge crowd gathered in Moscow. And reacting for this, the Kremlin decided to let Navalny to run for Moscow mayoral office. And Navalny that time did show pretty good results. He was the second with very high result, like 27%. I would say that now, after this film has been published, I'm afraid for Navalny's life, because Putin feels being humiliated. The leadership under him looks almost like a criminal gang. And that's why he needs to demonstrate all the time that he is a real leader, and he cannot let anybody to humiliate him. And this is exactly what I think will shape Kremlin's tactics with regard to Navalny.
Catherine, that's really interesting, because you've got two strands there. You've got what the Kremlin will do with Navalny and how the Kremlin will react to street protests. Now, let's look at street protests first in that. What are they going to do if the protests are big? And will they be big?
I think Navalny's supporters have done a very good job in the last couple of days in drumming up support. We've seen kind of this huge kind of show of support on social media networks. That I've read reports this morning which show calls to join the protests with the hashtag Navalny on January the 23rd have been viewed 50 million times on the internet. There seems to be kind of growing signs that the Russian law enforcement are getting very nervous. The Russian Interior Ministry this morning basically warned that there were attempts underway to kind of engineer a Belarus-style uprising in Russia this weekend. So it seems that law enforcement could well launch a very serious crackdown. They've already warned that any such gathering has not been authorized, that anyone participating could face arrest. I think Putin will not want to tolerate any risk that these protests could escalate. But of course, the more that he and the authorities crack down, the risk is the more the protesters will also dig their heels in. Now there are many of the younger population who've known nothing else apart from Putin's rule. And it certainly looks that the film Navalny produced this week has gained sort of wide viewing. I think 40 million have viewed it so far, and it looks like there's going to be quite a few people who come out onto the streets at the weekend.
Nikolai, finally, what do you think is going to happen?
This time, the Kremlin and police will put very tough pressure onto protesters. And this is a huge achievement of Navalny, that he did establish networks in many Russian regions. So he was able to establish almost a party which is not registered, but it's strong and it's represented in many regions of Russia. So we'll see, I think, protests in numerous cities, but perhaps not that huge. And what is very important about what will happen in 2 days from now, it's that decisions of the court in trial, which is scheduled for February 2nd, and where it should be decided whether to put Navalny for another 3.5 years into prison or something else. It will depend essentially from the scale of protests on Saturday.
If there are big crowds, is the Kremlin likely to be harder on Navalny or more lenient with Navalny?
I think the bigger is the risk of mobilization against the Kremlin, the more balanced will be behavior of the Kremlin with regard to Navalny. The more numerous protests are, the better for Navalny.
And likewise, if they're small protests, then Navalny's in trouble.
Yes.
Nikolai Petrov and Catherine Belton. My conclusions: No predictions from me on this one, I'm afraid. My thanks to Steve Rosenberg, Arkady Ostrovsky, Nikolai Petrov and Catherine Belton. We're back at the same time next week. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Sally Abrahams and Kirstine Knight. It was mixed by James Beard and edited by Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Like the recent one on what the NHS being overwhelmed really means.
Hello, I hope you've enjoyed the podcast you've just heard. There's another podcast available as well. It's called The Infinite Monkey Cage with me, Robin Ince, and...
me, Brian Cox. And it's going to be, I think, more educational than whatever it is that you just listened to, because we're going to consider subjects such as the nature of reality, which encompasses whatever it is that you just listened to.
So, yeah, Jan 11, Eric Idle, Frank Wilczek, Sarah Pascoe, Ross Noble, Chris Jackson, Alan Davis, David Dill. There's a huge number of people talking about many big ideas. There won't be that many equations. There might be one equation, won't there, Brian?
There will. And also Erica McAllister, Lady of the Flies, very 2021.
And you can hear The Infinite Monkey Cage on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, there's hundreds of them, actually.
Hundreds, loads of them. Who would have thought you could do over 100 episodes about everything that's in the universe? It's a lot more than I first imagined.
Why, you're a comedian, not a scientist.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.